Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the key suspect who planted the bomb that brought down the Russian airliner over the Sinai, the Islamic State affiliate Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, and speak with Mokhtar Awad, a research associate at the Center for American Progress, who was an intern in the Office of Egypt and Levant Affairs at the United States Department of State. He joins us to discuss the intelligence behind the growing belief that the Islamic State was behind the bombing and the extent to which the chronically bureaucratic Egyptian government is in denial about the inside job that likely took place at the Sharm el-Sheikh airport in the Sinai. Then we'll examine the nationwide Fight for 15 movement that is staging demonstrations involving thousands of fast food workers demanding a $15 an hour wage. Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist currently in Seattle, reporting on the role of the Service Employees International Union's fast food organizing campaign, joins us to discuss the 270 rallies across the nation today that are intended to influence the 2016 elections. Then finally, with the recent declassification of a presidential analysis of the 1983 NATO exercise Able Archer that put the Soviets on a nuclear hair trigger and almost resulted in a nuclear war, we will speak with Nate Jones, the person responsible for prying the heavily redacted report loose from the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and making it public. He is the director of the Freedom of Information Act project at the National Security Archive, and we will discuss the report on the 1983 nuclear war scare that Ronald Reagan found was really scary, and Nate Jones's article at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Countdown to Declassification. And joining us now is Mokhtar Awad, who's a research associate with the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on Islamist groups, Middle Eastern politics, and U.S. foreign policy towards the region. Prior to joining the Center for American Progress, he was a Carnegie Junior Fellow working in the Middle East program, and he previously completed an internship with the Office of Egypt and Levant Affairs in the Bureau of Near East Affairs at the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mokhtar Awad.
My pleasure.
And I take it that the Sinai, in general, is a kind of no man's land, and the area where the Russian airliner was shot down is pretty much in the midst of it all. And there's, of course, early claims from the self-declared Islamic State that they were responsible. And I take it that the intelligence that was that the British, I believe, provided to both the U.S. and to Russia may well have come from the Israelis, the intercepts. What's your understanding on the source of that intelligence?
Sure. The source, as reported, seems to be the Mossad, which, of course, is the best positioned to be able to intercept communications coming in and outside of the bordering Sinai. They quietly gave that information to the British, to the U.S., and that made its way to the Russians. This is, of course, of interest because in recent years, Egypt and Israel have been building a much stronger relationship, unprecedented relative to how the relations have been between these two countries. But the Israelis understood that the Egyptians will not necessarily take it the right way, that Israel is commenting on a terrorist attack that happened on Egyptian soil because of the tension between the two countries. And so that's why the chain of transferring that information made its way like this. But the information itself, we're not necessarily sure what exactly it contains. U.S. intelligence officials had said that they intercepted calls on their own, which spoke of vaguely of something big to happen, but they found it inconclusive. And these communications seems to be about celebrating for doing the attack, which in itself is not necessarily evidence, but as you can imagine, shortly after the plane was shot down, when we had no idea what had happened, a data point that suggests that IS commanders and leaders were celebrating and congratulating themselves. That's the reason why you kept having officials saying that they probably think that a bomb was involved. But now it seems that it's actually quite likely that the bomb was indeed involved, and so the intelligence may be vindicated.
But the fact that the British released this information when General Sisi was on a state visit to the UK to repair his international reputation, if you will, was a pretty bold move on the part of the British. What did you make of that?
Well, the British in this instance are motivated, of course, primarily by the need to kind of protect, obviously, their nationals. There are thousands of British nationals in Egypt. And in a way, these types of things generally go on autopilot. It wasn't necessarily the most politically sensitive moves, as you point out, to do, especially on a visit, especially this early in investigation. But from my, what I deduce from that is, and this is something that we see, the Egyptians initially still did not take seriously the prospect that it could have been a terrorist attack. And if so soon after an actual terrorist attack, the government in charge is still not radically changing the procedures in its airports, that may be unnecessary risk where a government like Britain, furious at this lack of action, begins to apply pressure on a country like Egypt by releasing this information to have Egypt confront the reality that it could have been a terrorist attack, and therefore they need to initiate certain protocols that lock down their airports and review exactly what had happened. And so that's probably why they decided to go ahead and do that.
Well, there's been an assumption that Putin doesn't want to let the Russian people know that this was a terrorist attack and likely a blowback from his intervention in Syria. And it's equally, I think, fairly clear that the Egyptian authorities don't want to affect their tourist industry and necessarily take responsibility for lax security at the Sharm el-Sheikh airport. So how are those factors playing into it, in your opinion?
To be honest, I wouldn't jump the gun and necessarily prejudge. I always like to keep options open. When it comes to the Egyptians, I think it's a little bit of both. There's a recognition that if they do come across a smoking gun, they will have a conversation about what to do with it. But right now, I don't think that they know that it's a terrorist attack and are denying it. I think it's actually perhaps something worse, that they may be avoiding certain information that may challenge their assumptions. And so I think guiding it in that way when it comes to the Egyptians, of course, a country with a huge bureaucracy, great levels of incompetency, and it's not necessarily, I think, malicious intent or manipulation of data at this stage, but more genuinely the fact that they just simply do not want to accept that it was a terrorist attack. When it comes to the Russians, it's a bit more nuanced, where they still want to balance what information kind of comes out, because the brilliant thing that ISIS did with this, and of course they're playing a game, sticking out their tongue, if you will, to the world, what they said was very carefully worded. They said, when your governments and your information, can prove that we did it, you have to prove that we did it. We will bring out the details whenever we want. Now, if these governments do have suspicion, and they're not saying it, but they do have suspicion that it was a bomb, the possibility of them coming out and conclusively saying that it wasn't, and then IS comes out with conclusive evidence that it was, that damages their credibility in a very, very strong and obvious way. And so I think that's why they will hesitate before, if they do come across information that suggests it's a bomb, for them to try and manipulate that, just because they don't know what IS has. And so it's a very interesting game at play here.
And again, I'm speaking with Mokhtar Awad, who's a research associate in the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on Islamist groups, Middle East politics, and U.S. foreign policy towards the region. And prior to joining the Center for American Progress, he was a Carnegie Junior Fellow working in the Middle East program, and he previously completed an internship with the Office of Egypt and Levant Affairs in the Bureau of Near East Affairs at the United States Department of State. Now, but one question, though, you quoted in Tuesday's New York Times, Mokhtar, and along with Will McCants at Brookings, he takes the position that it doesn't make a lot of sense for the Islamic State in headquartered in Raqqa in Syria to take credit because they're just inviting a pounding by the Russians. So what do you make of that deduction?
I think, obviously, the best way for us to look at it is what is the rationale when it comes to other state actors, rogue states in the Middle East who have used terror as a tool of war. They have the perception that this advances their interests. They're willing to absorb the risks for the propaganda value, but also because they think that this establishes a principle of deterrence, as twisted as it may be. We saw this with Gaddafi. We saw this with Iran. Some could argue that Iran used it successfully because it was able to, put on the table so many worst options of what it can do, namely a nuclear bomb. And therefore, governments had to kind of accept the fact that Iran has this outsized role. But bringing it to ISIS, I think they think that this establishes a principle of deterrence, and that's what I say in the article. And they're willing to absorb the risks that Will McCants is talking about. Will is right that it doesn't necessarily make much sense that they would wish to invite this upon themselves. But I think something that's overlooked, and it may be true that IS is technically not receiving the worst of the pounding from the Russians at the moment, the Russians at the end of the day cannot bring the same force as the U.S. or the British can, or any other Western country can. So, in fact, there's actually a limited amount of damage that the Russians can bring upon ISIS vis-a-vis what the United States has done to them thus far, if that makes sense. The second is that there's also a very useful propaganda value. ISIS has an image problem in Syria, less so in Iraq. In Syria, one of the main reasons why a largely Islamist-influenced opposition now and al-Qaeda are able to kind of thrive and make their case is that ISIS is not attacking assets sufficiently. And ISIS recognizes this. And when you attack Russia, the most hated foreign power inside Syria, far more so than the Americans, because the larger swath of Syrians look at Russia as a primary backer of Bashar al-Assad, who are now bombing civilians more. When ISIS does that, it sends a message that they want to position themselves as, quote, the defenders of these people. And it begins to chip away at the perception that they're not attacking the Assad access sufficiently. And, of course, there's a more practical reason of why they perhaps targeted a Russian plane is that it actually is just easier and more in the art of the possible than an American airliner or a British airliner. And so it's a confluence of factors where the basic bottom line is, I think they look at this as deterrence, as a win-win when it comes to propaganda and deterrence, but also they think they're able to absorb the risks.
But does this mean that ISIS or Daesh will actually go after the Assads? I mean, as you pointed out, al-Nusra and the other affiliates, including some that the U.S. supports, seem to be doing the brunt of the fighting around Latakia and in Damascus itself, where al-Nusra's been lobbing mortars into the compound of the Russian embassy in Damascus.
You know, this is something that's interesting. The problem, that we see with ISIS and Assad now is a little bit different from how things were in late 2012 and 2013, where they were practically avoiding each other. Up until, since 2014, there actually have been clashes between Assad and ISIS. Now, not that significant, but we have seen, for instance, cities like Palmyra falling in the hands of ISIS from the Assad regime. But I think ISIS is still calculating whether or not it's in its best interest to now go after the Assad regime in full force. And the calculus that they have been using, where they were manipulating the battleground to their advantage, is changing. So we shouldn't look at what's been happening in 2013 and 2012, is what I'm saying, and assume that this can inform us on what future strategy. I think now they may begin to recognize that with a few strategic victories here and there, lumped up with the Russian bombing, they can prove or show themselves as fighting Assad, but still not overall upset the balance of forces on the ground. And, of course, the weaker Assad becomes, the easier for them to do that. But it's a very complicated and convoluted game. But I think we shouldn't take out of the question how ISIS, just as it went after Russia, might want to go after Assad a little bit more, because that now begins to discredit its own adversaries in the Islamist opposition and puts ISIS in a better position.
So just returning to the Sinai, to Sharm el-Sheikh, and the possibility that agents of the Islamic State, or affiliates, I guess maybe a better way to describe it, were able to plant a bomb aboard the Russian airliner. What's your understanding of the independence of these so-called affiliates of the Islamic State in the Sinai?
You know, up until the interesting thing about this attack is that up until this attack, it wasn't clear if the affiliates were just alliances on paper or not. But with this attack, because the local affiliate group has painstakingly avoided targeting civilian casualties en masse or tourist targets incessantly. Now, just as a side note, it's not because they're good guys, but because in Egypt, there's such a long history of jihadism, probably far, actually thus far exceed anywhere else in the Arab world. And in there, the jihadis recognize that when they start killing civilians in large numbers and attack the tourism sector, which employs roughly 15% or so of the Egyptian population, directly or indirectly, that begins to chip away and eat away at their base of popular support. And now we see with this attack a radical transformation in the posture of a group that has avoided specifically these types of attacks, which leads me to believe that an evolution happened with the group where it became more and more influenced by IS, agents that were being sent by IS for training purposes and vice versa, but also that I think it's more likely than not that IS played either a very influential role in making this happen or gave a direct order, because this advances their interests far more so than the local affiliates. And if the local affiliates may be able to pull this off once and can suffer the consequences of its own theater, ISIS can sit back and bask in the glory of not only the fact that it has claimed such a spectacular attack in its name, but it also successfully showed how it can project force far outside its borders with a proxy that's on the ground.
So you mentioned earlier, Mukhtar Awad, that the first of all, that the Egyptian government is a kind of sclerotic bureaucracy, and also that they may well just be simply in denial at this point. But I think it's pretty clear that they haven't really invested in the Sinai, and that the Bedouin population there is fairly anti-government, either from neglect or, you know, from, I mean, something has happened, surely, to that part of the world to turn that area into a kind of no man's land with, yeah, you've got criminal gangs, all kinds of smuggling going on, and now you've got these jihadist elements as well.
Sure, and to clarify, the no man's land is really the northeast of the Sinai. The Sinai is a huge, huge landmass, and only the north and the south are populated, and the middle sparsely so. The south is actually very prosperous. In any case, the problem really dates back to the fact that there were multiple wars in the Sinai between Egypt and Israel. So the area there, of course, got destroyed many times over, with a long stretch of Israeli occupation from 67 pretty much until Egyptian sovereignty is back in 82. The population there, which is very mercantile, no-nonsense, and all that kind of stuff, some of them actually were working with the Israelis and were benefiting. And obviously the Israelis showered them with stuff because they wanted to buy their favor. And in a way, they built an economy. And soon after the war, Egypt was, of course, very exhausted and didn't really have much resources. The last possible thing that they would have done is to rebuild the place that keeps getting on destroying, and that's so far in the periphery. And so that's just some context of why the region is like this. But it's not just the fact that there's lack of development or government neglect. The sad reality about Egypt, the most populous Arab state, is around 40% of the population lives on $2 or less. And so there are actually other areas in Egypt with much worse abject poverty. But those people don't rise up in revolt, and they're still loyal to the state. In the Sinai, it's because of this history of occupation and because of this lack of trust that exists between the security services largely and the tribes, because security services look at the tribes as people who are in it for their own good, who have collaborated with the Israelis and therefore cannot be trusted. And this is something that can only be bridged, not by just building hospitals or roads or anything like that, but a view for a political process or political inclusivity where there is party development in these areas, where there is greater representation in parliaments that could be disproportionate just because of the context of the history there. So the reason why I say that, because of course it's a very small population, but they should be giving more seats to kind of feel that they're included. And more importantly, to kind of, you know, address some of the other issues that are born out of the economic disadvantages, which is the smuggling that exists. Of course, there's weapon smuggling, drug smuggling, mainly with Gaza. It used to be up to a point, still happens, but far less so. People smuggling, that requires obviously providing economic opportunity, but also in order to kind of tackle the complex security environment, because if you do all of that, if Egypt turns North Sinai into Sweden, you will still have in these vast deserts, jihadists who are looking to set up a base there, even if it's just for the purpose of attacking Israel. And so what that means is that besides the political side and the economic side, the Egyptians need to utilize the Bedouins in their local policing units so that the Bedouins can keep track of who's moving in and who's moving out and begin to have more responsibility in their own security. And so that's the reason why, you know, things are at this stage and what could be done about it.
Well, just in the last minute, Mukhtar Awad, what do you think, when do you think we'll know something concrete, given the strong indications that this was a bomb planted aboard the plane by agents of the Islamic State?
I'm afraid it's something that really cannot be known. The thing about these investigations, they can take months. They can even take years. I remember there was a flight that blew up in 96 or 97 here in the States and ended up being a fuel tank explosion. It's actually very similar to this one. I think it was TWA 800 or 600 or something like that. And to this day, it took more than a year for the investigation to conclude, because no one believed that a plane would have just been got destroyed in the air without foul play. And to this day, you still have people with conspiracy theories that it was a terrorist attack, but it was covered up. And I kid you not that the U.S. Navy misfired a missile that hit the plane. So the point is, with these investigations, they take a long time. And even when they get concluded, no one is usually ever satisfied with the responses they get if they don't prove their own theory about what happened.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mukhtar Awad.
No problem. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mokhtar Awad, who is a research associate with the National Security and International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on Islamic groups, Middle Eastern politics, and U.S. foreign policy towards the region. And prior to joining the Center for American Progress, he was a Carnegie Junior Fellow working in the Middle East program, and he previously completed an internship with the Office of Egypt and Levant Affairs in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the United States Department of State. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Fight for 15 movement that is staging 270 rallies across the nation today. شجر الحكاية مواويل طرب وناسة Welcome back. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7. I'm Ian Masters, and joining us now is Arun Gupta, who is an investigative journalist who has written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He's the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper and the Occupy Wall Street Journal, and he's currently writing a book on the politics of food. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arun Gupta.
How are you doing, Ian?
Very well, thank you. You're in Seattle, and I understand that the Fight for 15 movement is being underwritten by the Service Employees International Union, and there are 270 rallies across the country. And the intention of the movement is to influence the 2016 elections. That appears to already be happening with Hillary Clinton offering her support. Bernie Sanders joining a rally on the steps of, in Washington, the governor of New York saying that New York state workers will be getting $15 an hour, de Blasio, the mayor of New York, and the mayor of Pittsburgh, also announcing $15 an hour. So is that your sense that this thing is working politically?
Well, yeah, I think they clearly have gained more influence in the Democratic Party. When I first started reporting on the movement more than 2 years ago, a national labor strategist who I talked to explained, you don't do a campaign of this size without having a whole series of nested strategies. In other words, it's one strategy inside another. So, you know, part of it is that SEIU wants to build a greater base of union members and wanted to improve its public image. But this strategist was also clear that the SEIU wanted more influence within the Democratic Party. You know, of course, they'd like influence within the Republican Party, but that's not going to happen. They're really hoping to curry favor with Democratic politicians, and it has worked. But the question is this really improving the lives of the workers? Because we're told that's what the campaign is supposed to be about, not whether a union has more leverage within the Democratic Party.
Well, but if the wages are raised, as have been announced, that's real money, isn't it? I mean, obviously, there's a big difference between the mayors and the governors and the candidates. In the case of the mayors and the governor, that is a real deal. Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are offering their support. But at the federal level, you're never going to get the Republicans in the Congress to agree to $15, are you?
Yeah, no, I think it is unlikely. I mean, that was more of a rhetorical question, you know, because what I was doing was setting up to say that, you know, SEIU has clearly been effective, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. They've set thousands of workers in motion. They've made low wages and the plight of low wage workers a national issue. We've seen in various cities, Seattle, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and New York, these $15 wage bills passed that, you know, they're phased in for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. So these are real gains. But what I'm trying to get at is more the complexity and why we need to think about how do you actually change the more fundamental issues of inequality, right? The reason we had this kind of golden age of the middle class was not because the capitalists decided, oh, we need to pay workers more. It's because they fought, they died, they built these militant workers' movements. So in the cities where we've seen $15 wages implemented, every single one of these cities also has a severe housing crisis. And I was just looking at the data in Seattle, the first city to pass $15 an hour. The rent increases, and if you're a low-wage worker, you're almost certainly renting. The rent increases are basically outstripping most of the wage gains for most workers. They have different schedules. So for some workers, they may be actually earning a little more than their rent is going up. But for most workers, the rental increases are actually outstripping their wage gains. So they're falling further behind, even though their wages are increasing. This is the complexity of the plight of low-wage workers. But we don't hear about this because it doesn't fit in a soundbite. And that's where you find so many workers themselves and organizers, and I've talked to over 40 of them, who are all very critical of the campaign because it is what they call a march on the media. It's not building worker power. It's not building this independent movement. Eventually, SEIU is going to pull the plug, and they will, because this campaign has cost them reportedly well over $100 million. And when they do, all these workers are then left in the lurch. Maybe they will have gotten some wage increases in some cities, but it's not fundamentally changing their plight, which is what we're told this campaign is about.
So what would change their plight?
Well, I think the power needs to come from the workers themselves. That, you know, what hopefully we should have been seeing is a kind of shop floor organizing. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that. When I've talked to workers, in only a few instances do you actually find the workers in the fast food restaurants are being trained in these SEIU campaign chapters in how do you actually engage in on the shop actions? How do you actually organize your shop? How do you fight back against the boss, against retaliation? Rather, what they're being trained in is they're being trained in how do you speak before the camera? How do you tell your story? How do you be a good spokesperson? And it's not that those aren't useful tools. That's not, though, the sum of what organizing is about. If you're just training people in being media spokesperson, what it means is you're just essentially a number of organizers have pointed out this is essentially the same type of technique that NGOs use for the third world. You know, it's basically caring about poor brown children in Africa strategy. They're trying to appeal to the white liberal middle class that you should care about these poor, you know, workers rather than the workers helping the workers develop their own power. And I was just talking to one organizer, SEIU organizer today, who was laughing, who started laughing when I was talking about building worker power. And he's like, that's the last thing SEIU wants. They don't want to activate their rank and file. He was saying they're notorious for suppressing rank and file democracy. So we have to evaluate, you know, what are the claims versus what is actually happening. And there's a big distance between the two. And that's not to say they don't deserve credit for such things that have happened mainly in the PR realm about changing the conversation, about raising the plight of low-wage workers, which has translated into some wage gains. But to get back to the main point, it's not fundamentally changing the situation of low-wage workers.
And again, I'm speaking with Arun Gupta, who's an investigative journalist who has written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He's the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper and the Occupy Wall Street Journal. And he's currently writing a book on the politics of food. But in terms of I mean, the other alternative, of course, it would be workers going on strike, and I'm not sure how effective that would be. But at least in Oakland today, roughly 50 fast food workers and union organizers did fly to McDonald's, and they temporarily forced the restaurant to stop serving food. What's your sense then of the option of striking? If that's the traditional means of organized labor, would that be effective?
Yeah, I mean, the power of labor is the power to withdraw its labor, right? That has always been what gives labor such tremendous social force that it stops the point of production. Now, you know, what you're saying is you have all these folks, and, you know, what I'm wondering is, like, often, again, when I'm talking, you know, what you have to understand is this: the information I'm giving you is coming directly from the organizers and workers themselves. Like, there are people who try and criticize what I say. It's like, oh, I'm just on the outside lobbing in grenades. It's just like, no, I've interviewed more than 40 workers and organizers across the country. And in fact, it's probably over 60 at this point in the last 2 years. So I'm in touch with the people who are on the front lines of the movement. And for one thing, they often tell me when you see these marches, they're like, it's mainly union staff and community group members. Often the workers themselves are in the minority. We've seen actually very few shutdowns. You can probably count it on one, maybe two hands in the last 2 years that shops have actually been closed for an entire day. That's exceedingly rare, right? That's a particular form of power that has not been used. And a number of organizers independently have told me the same thing in different cities. They felt what should have happened is SEIU should have just flooded one city. You know, they have a lot of resources, but they have a limited amount of resources. They can't do this in the whole country at the same time. But they could have sent, you know, like a couple hundred organizers to just one city, like, say, Chicago, and really try to organize the fast food sector there, but to organize them into actual kind of militant shops. And we also have to understand the SEIU strategy is what's known as a staff-driven strategy. There are other strategies where you have worker strategies. You also have the strategy of what's known as salting, where you put the staff members in the shops and they organize them from the inside. So what we're seeing is one particular form of strategy, and unfortunately we don't have the time, you know, to really get into what all the options are. And we need to understand that this is a very specific type of strategy that tends to be a media and PR strategy. It can have a positive effect, but it's not going to have the effect that people think it's having.
But the reality still remains, though, that more than 4 in 10 employees in the United States workforce earn less than $15 an hour, and that's and that includes 96% of fast food workers. So the fact that this you've been critical of what the tactics of the SEIU, who apparently have at least managed to raise the consciousness and affect New York City and Pittsburgh and New York State now with Governor Cuomo mandating state employees getting $15 an hour. What's going to happen to 4 out of 10 workers? I mean, if who's stepping up to the plate for them, and what strategies are out there for them if the SEIU's strategies that have had some success so far you don't feel they're sufficient. Who's coming up with a strategy for the 4 in 10 workers in the country?
No, I agree. And you know, like I say, they deserve credit for raising these issues, for making it part of the national conversation. But we have to understand that it's not enough. And you know, look, I think this is a good example, right, that we talk wages, and of course wages matter. But when you're a low-wage worker, your plight is not just about wages, right? It's also, it has to do with scheduling. It's, are you getting a full 40 hours? Can you pick up another job if you're not getting a full 40 hours because at least you know you have a regular schedule? What are the benefits you're getting? Are you subject to wage theft at the workplace? The wage theft is one area that SEIU has raise the issue, but then there are also all the broader community issues, right? They're just like, what is your commute like? A lot of these low-wage workers have 2 to 3 hour commutes a day because they have to rely on terrible mass transit system. They're living in substandard, often dilapidated housing in terrible conditions. They have inadequate public services. The school systems their children go to are often terrible. They're often, it intersects with over-policing and the criminal justice system. And when you have a bottom-up movement, when the people are actually in control of it, you know, say when you're talking about something more like the Black Lives Matter movement, you'll hear many more issues coming to the fore because they're coming out of the people's own struggle. They're not coming out of a centralized union leadership in Washington that is saying, we want to see how we can increase our influence in the Democratic Party. We want to see how we can have a better public image. Their needs are different than the needs of the workers, frankly. But that is the reality. So the needs of the many of the needs, most important needs of the workers, are never going to even be addressed. And that's also confirmed by both organizers and workers who I've talked to, that they're often unable to raise all these other issues in the SEIU organizing meetings, that there is no forum to raise them because these meetings are not organizing forums. They're just given marching orders. Their pep talk rallies, their cheerleading, they're all intended to basically carry out a strategy SEIU has determined, rather than actually engage the workers in real movement building.
Well, Arun Gupta, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, who's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He's a founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper and Occupy Wall Street Journal. And he's currently writing a book on the politics of food. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the almost nuclear war in 1983.
You receive, but always want more. But the day is coming, the day is near, the day is coming, you know what I mean.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nate Jones, the director of the Freedom of Information Act project for the National Security Archive. He oversees the thousands of Freedom of Information Act and mandatory declassification review requests and the hundreds of appeals that the archive submits each year. He has also produced the Abel Archer 83 source book, the comprehensive declassified collection of documents on the 1983 nuclear war scare, and his article Countdown to Declassification in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists examines the intersection of Abel Archer 83 nuclear miscalculation and government secrecy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nate Jones.
Thank you.
And why do you think, I've followed this story for decades now, and I've been waiting for it to come out because it's always struck me as being an extraordinarily important story that we almost had a nuclear war in November of 1983, and nobody knows about it. And it was arguably could have been as close to as the Cuba crisis was, but it all happened in secret, if you will, and it's remained a secret, even though it clearly had some extraordinary effects, particularly on President Ronald Reagan himself. So why then, if indeed, as I understand it, the Abel Archer incident really created a kind of sea change in Ronald Reagan, the the hawk became a dove, and it led in to the finally when they found somebody on the other side they could talk to. After Andropov died, then Chernyenko died, and then finally they got Gorbachev. Things clearly changed, and the Cold War ended. So why is it that they don't want to take credit for the effect of Abel Archer had on bringing about the end of the Cold War? You know, at the same time, is there an element of embarrassment about how the world almost blew up? Why is it that, why have they kept it secret? Because you've been rattling their cages for 11 years getting this material out. So what's been the resistance you've been facing?
Sure. I think first, Ian, it's not just you that feels that way. There's a secret National Security Agency history that has been declassified. And in that history, the National Security Agency calls 1983 the most dangerous nuclear era since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So people inside the government with their clearances have admitted this. And I think to your question of why doesn't the public at large know, I think there is an element of feet stuck in concrete and the element of self-servingness. Secrecy can be self-serving. The agencies in charge of nuclear weapons forces, I think, are not anxious to have the public know about the risk of miscalculation. There's another element of the inertia of the bureaucracy. Some of these documents had to be reviewed by the way the law is set up by 15 different agencies. And what that happens is you have years, sometimes decades, of documents getting lost in the mail, not reviewed, different reviews. And the end result is a public that doesn't know this dangerous history until now, finally. And I'll give you one more anecdote. I was working on this for 11 years, and I filed my first ever Freedom of Information Act request on this because I got so angry as a historian that we couldn't figure out what was going on. And for the 11 years after, I went to the National Security Archive and learned all about the Freedom of Information Act because I got so angry that the government was keeping this important information secret. And after that, as you said, I filed hundreds more. And if they would have just given me the dang document in the first place, I would have left them alone. So the sad news is it takes so long and you really have to dedicate yourself to a fight for such important information. But the good news is that this shows that the good guys, the historians, the journalists will win eventually.
So just to sort of set the context for Abel Archer, you have to go back to when Brezhnev was still, he was obviously ailing, but he was still the general secretary in charge of the Soviet Union. And the KGB and the GRU were ordered to get together and look for signs. This is when Ronald Reagan first was elected. And right out of the gate, he talked about the evil empire and that the Russians would end up on the ash heap of history. And, of course, the Soviets had a system that was based on rhetoric. To them, rhetoric was reality. The five-year plans, even though they were never met, that was the rhetoric. So they take rhetoric very seriously. So when Weinberger says that the Russians are going to end up in the ash heap of history, I think actually Reagan may have said that too, they take that literally. So they ordered the GRU and the KGB to get together and under what they call Operation Ryan, Rikete Yalinoye Nepodenye, which means the nuclear attack out of the blue, a preemptive strike. And they dedicated all their intelligence assets starting in 82 all the way through as things escalated. And there's a whole series of escalations with the Evil Empire speech in front of the evangelicals. The KGB said to the leadership, see, this is their mindset, you know. And then you had Star Wars, which was, they believed, was a real program. Why would the Americans announce it if it wasn't real? And then you go all the way through the Pershing and cruise missile deployments, and then the invasion of Grenada that came out of nowhere, essentially to cover up the loss of the Marines in Lebanon. And then into November of 83, then you had the KAL shoot down, which Andropov was convinced was a CIA provocation, etc. So you can see on the Russian side, the building paranoia. And then you then start this nuclear exercise, which is predicated upon NATO's doctrine, which was the first use of nuclear weapons, because the Warsaw Pact had a preponderance of conventional power, military power. And so I've brought us up to that position. So What happens? How bad did it get in that, I think it was around November the 14th, wasn't it?
Sure. Well, the drill started on November 7th, and with this Operation Rion going on, where Soviet intelligence agencies abroad in all countries had a huge undertaking of being tasked to report the indicators of pending nuclear war. And one of the agents that did this said, yeah, we reported them all. I was in the West, so I believed they didn't want to have an actual strike, but my job wasn't to say that. My job was to write the reports as dire as possible. So they did. And while this was going on, there is a pending deployment of these new super sudden first strike Pershing 2 missiles that could hit Russia, and it was thought, and it's still a bit unclear if they could hit Moscow or not, within 7 minutes from West Germany. And this upended the whole nuclear order. And this was the first drill, and there were fears, legitimate fears, we now know, from the Soviets, that it could be a bolt from the blue, so to speak, or decapitating first use strike. And Abel Archer practiced this. And the Soviets reported it, and their assets in East Germany also reported it. So what occurred was, first, there was the actual radio silent deployment of 19,000 American troops to Western Europe. And they simulated this big conventional war with all these troops and all these actual movements. And both the Soviets and the U.S. believed that an actual attack could occur from masking, so-called masking, and using a drill to mask an actual attack. And then after this conventional tens of thousands of NATO exercise ended with the Soviets breaking through Germany, NATO practiced launching an actual war. So they had readied their bombers. They put fake but realistically looking nuclear warheads onto their planes. They wore their gas masks. They moved to alternate headquarters. They simulated requesting permission from the UK and US to strike. And then on the 11th of November, they had a simulated countdown all the way from DEFCON, I believe, 3 to DEFCON 1, and then to General Alert, which was launching the nukes. And while they were doing this, during this period of extreme tension, they used codes that had never been used before and brand new encryption. So while they were practicing a nuclear war, the Soviets were reporting that it may be real. And that was the peak of the Abel Archer crisis.
And the West had a double agent inside the Russian embassy in London who was reporting directly to MI6. And my understanding is that in this highly simulated, realistic Abel Archer 83 exercise, the heads of states were evacuated to their nuclear bunkers. Is that right?
I think the most newly released document doesn't mention anything about that. But what did occur was that all of the war gamers moved to alternate headquarters, which would have raised eyebrows in the Rion indicators, and they asked permission to launch nuclear war, to launch nuclear weapons to London and Washington, which also would have raised eyebrows. But the evidence now looks like the heads of state were not involved.
Well, we know that on the Russian side in October of 83, they mistook some refractions off clouds, some peculiar kind of light phenomenon, as the plumes of a Minuteman battery launch, and they had an automatic system to preempt, and the Soviet launch officer simply did not follow protocol and press the button and start a nuclear war, because he didn't think for a minute that the U.S. would strike with just a handful of Minuteman missiles, that they'd fire a huge salvo. and thus he saved the world. And it sounds in many ways that on the American side during the Able Archer exercise, that this Lieutenant General Leonard Peroutz did something the same. Is that, am I correct in that?
Sure. More research needs to be done. But during the height of the exercise, Soviets readied their nuclear-capable aircraft. They stopped all of their air traffic so that they could preserve their planes to launch an attack. There is abnormal activity in the North Sea, probably looking for American cruisers streaming in. And General Peroutz, who was Chief of Staff for Air Force Intelligence, according to this newly declassified report, acted out of instinct, not information, because the U.S. intelligence missed this war scare. And according to this, he was fortuitous if ill-informed. But he decided not to raise the U.S. alert levels. And that was the moment where things stabilized. And it wasn't after until initially weeks after that British intelligence realized the danger. Probably they combined Gordievsky, this double agent's reporting of the danger, with signals intelligence, seeing the increased nuclear readiness, and then sent that information to Washington. And according to this report, it reached President Reagan in mid-1984, and he said it was really scary. But he also wrote in his journal in November 1983, perhaps just by coincidence or perhaps he somehow knew at the time, that's also still unclear, that something had to change with the Russians. He had to get a Soviet in the room and tell them that the U.S. had no intention to attack. He wrote that in his journal just 10 days after the end of Able Archer.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to McFarlane about that, and he also went public in January of 1983 with a very dovish outreach to the Russians, and they sent Brent Scowcroft over there to try and meet with the Russians, but that trip was sabotaged by the State Department, and there was nobody to meet with on the other side until Gorbachev came along. So it had a profound effect on Reagan to recognize that his words, the actor's words, taunting the wounded bear, actually almost brought about a nuclear war and led in many ways directly to the end of the Cold War. So it's a very significant story. And I don't understand why the government's been sitting on it all this time. Look, we have run out of time and, you know, we've barely scratched the surface with this story, Nate. Can we do a follow-up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time, and thank you so much for this. Where can people get this information? I know there's a CIA report that's not particularly good, but of the 1983 war scare. But your report, how do they get it?
We have the largest collection, all the documents, this report, nsarchive.org.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nate Jones, who's the director of the Freedom of Information Act project for the National Security Archives. He oversees thousands of Freedom of Information Act and mandatory declassification review requests and the hundreds of appeals that the archive submits each year. He has also produced the Able Archer 83 Sourcebook, the comprehensive declassified collection of documents on the 1983 nuclear war scare, and his article, Countdown to Declassification in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, examines the intersection of Able Archer 83, nuclear miscalculation, and government secrecy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.